Do you find yourself searching for true crime podcasts that are different from what you're always recommended? Do you want to make a real difference in the cases that you're following? Well, you're a crime junkie, and I'm Ashley Flowers, the creator and host of the number one true crime podcast, Crime Junkie. There are hundreds of episodes already available, and each Monday, we dive into the details of cases spanning from some of the most infamous to those that you have never heard covered before. Listen to Crime Junkie podcast now, wherever you're listening.
Good evening, everyone. Welcome to The Readout. Jason Johnson in for Joy Reid. Begin tonight with the breaking news out of Moscow, where a shooting attack has left at least 40 dead and over 100 injured. That's according to Russian state news agencies. This is what we know right now. The attack occurred at Krokus City Hall, a large concert venue northwest of central Moscow. Warning to our viewers, we are about to show some disturbing video. You're now seeing the inside of the concert hall where at least three men in camouflage broke in and opened fire, shooting an unknown number of people. Russian officials say several of these gunmen fired automatic weapons at the crowd. A fire also started inside the venue. Firefighters have evacuated about 100 people from the basement of the buildings, and efforts are underway to rescue people from the roof. Who committed this and why is still very much unknown. Islamic State, you know, as ISIS, has claimed responsibility, but without providing proof for the attack on the concert venue. Their claim came from an ISIS-affiliated account on Telegram. NBC News has not yet verified the claim, but Russian officials said they were investigating the attack as a terrorist attack. Let's bring in Michael McFaul, former U.S. ambassador to Russia, Peter Baker, chief White House correspondent for The New York Times, who previously was Moscow bureau chief for The Washington Post, and former CIA director John Brennan. Thank you all, gentlemen, so much for joining us evening. John, I want to start with you on this. The idea that ISIS or someone in control of the ISIS Telegram account has claimed responsibility for this, how credible is that just from your experience? And what would be the motivation for ISIS to commit this kind of terror attack in Russia?
Well, it's a very credible claim, especially given that the U.S. Embassy issued a public warning earlier this month about extremists planning to carry out attack. And that term extremists usually refers to these fanatical Islamist groups. And ISIS-K, which is the one believed to be responsible for this, has long felt that the Russians have bloodily suppressed the Muslims in Syria and Afghanistan and in the Caucasus as well. And so, therefore, I think Islamic militants, it's very believable that they were the ones to carry out this attack. The fact that they just mowed down individuals, and clearly it was an effort to try to cause havoc and kill as many people as possible. And so, therefore, I do believe that we're hearing at least some initial reports, including from some American officials, that it was ISIS, which is a large group now. It has a number of umbrella groups underneath it that really was from Afghanistan, from Pakistan, in that area. And it looks as though that this was planned for quite some time because they were able to defeat Russian security services and carry out this attack.
Ambassador McFaul, it's both shocking and surprising to see this sort of attack happen within Russia. Almost immediately, we heard from an aide from President Zelensky in Ukraine saying, tweeting out, Ukraine certainly has nothing to do with the shooting explosions at Krokus City Hall, Moscow region Russian. It makes no sense whatsoever. Just strategically speaking, obviously it makes sense for the Ukraine to immediately come out and disavow any sort of association with this. Is that something that we can find credible right now? Is it something that they're just saying because they need to say this? Or would it really be foolish strategically for the Ukrainians who are in a very bloody battle to resist Russian aggression to be anywhere connected to something like this?
Well, I think it's very credible. And it's consistent with the pattern of the way that Ukraine is fighting Russia and the invading forces in their country right now. They're doing whatever it takes to try to fight back. They are striking targets inside Russia, what they consider to be military targets, and I believe that to be true. But they have never done terrorist attacks, at least to the best of my knowledge, against Russians anywhere. And therefore, this is consistent with them not doing that. I would just underscore that that's opposite from the way that the Russian government fights inside Ukraine, where they are terrorizing Ukrainian civilians all the time, including just last night in the capital city of Kiev. But Ukraine does not fight that way. And now that we have, ISIS-K taking credit for it, I think that, until proven otherwise, it should be the working hypothesis. And those Russians, including some former officials that immediately blamed Ukraine, that to me was a very shameful act.
And Ambassador, I just want to follow up with this. I looked up a little bit about the group that was performing. It's a rock band that's been around since the late 70s called Picnic. They actually were banned from performing in the Ukraine since 2016 because they performed in Crimea. Do you think that there was any sort of symbolism to this? Do you think that not just the venue, but the band had anything to do with this? Or do you really think, again, it's more likely to be ISIS because it doesn't fit the strategy of the Ukrainian army?
I don't know. That's a great question. I don't know the answer. I mean, I do know the band, by the way, and it's kind of a kind of hippie band from the the late 70s, early 80s. It's not a pro-Putin kind of group that would be there if I were guesstimating. But I don't know of any particular reason why they would strike there, other than the fact that the owner of this complex is close to Mr. Putin. So maybe that is why they targeted this particular place.
Peter Baker, I want to step back for a second. The world has made it pretty clear that they want to be on the right side of history. You know, there aren't many people backing Russia's invasion of Ukraine. It's not a popular war even within Russia. So what are sort of Putin's options here? Because when you have an attack like this happen, even right after a landslide election that he just recently won, does this weaken him? Are there allies that are going to come to his aid for an investigation into this attack? Where does Putin find sort of a sensitive or empathetic ear after facing this sort of attack, given what his army has been doing in Ukraine for almost 2 years now?
Yeah, I think that's a fair point. He doesn't have a lot of sympathy, at least certainly in the West, not in Europe or the United States. He did, though, get a warning from the United States about this very attack. Not only did the U.S. Embassy say on March 7th that there was indications of some sort of a large-scale possible attack by extremists, including at a concert venue, but American officials say that they specifically talked to the Russian government about that, gave them whatever information that they had to give them at that time. So they did have help from the United States, even as we are, of course, at odds over Ukraine. But you're right to ask the question of what Putin does now, because this makes him look weak, at least in his eyes. He has historically looked at terrorist attacks in Moscow, which were quite common 20 years ago, around the time he first came to power, as an opportunity to, as a show of weakness on his part, which he needs to dispel, and use them as an opportunity then to make political moves that crack down on dissent. For instance, I was in Russia in 2004 when terrorists took over a school in the small town of Beslan. And the first thing that happened after 330 people died, including about half of them school children, the first thing that Vladimir Putin did after that was to, first of all, he blamed the West. And second of all, he canceled all elections of governors from then on, not just governors in the region where it happened, not just temporarily, but all across the 11 time zones of Russia. Why? Because it was an opportunity for him to say, we need more central control from the Kremlin in a country where such a terrorist attack could happen. You can easily see him using this as an excuse to further clamp down on dissent. There's not a lot of room for dissent as it is in Russia right now. He spent 20 years getting rid of that. But that would be his natural playbook looking at history.
Former Director Brennan, I want to go back to this idea that Putin had a warning, right? That even the United States said, hey, look, this could potentially happen. You're in danger, et cetera, et cetera. Just for the uninformed and uninitiated, we are on the opposite side of Russia. We are defending Ukraine. The Russian Federation is still considered a problem. There's no issue. There's no question there unless you happen to be a certain kind of Republican. What is the incentive? What was the incentive of the United States to give warnings on terrorist attacks like this to Putin's government? And the fact that this came true, does it in any way thaw relations? Are there any sort of undercover thank yous that are occurring? Or do the Russians just sort of ignore this and say, well, you warned us about something, but that just makes you suspicious in our eyes?
The U.S. intelligence community takes very seriously its responsibility that's called duty to warn. If the U.S. intelligence gets information about planned terrorist attacks against targets around the world, and it's credible, it's reliable, and especially if it's specific, which this was, we will share that information with the foreign services, the security and intelligence services. And clearly, there was some significant specificity to this when there was reference to concert halls and in coming days. And so the timing of this warning, I think, was very much on target in terms of what happened here. I'm sure it was passed to the Russian security services. I don't know what the Russians did with it. There is a regular channel between U.S. intelligence and Russian intelligence to share this information. And so therefore, I don't know any additional information that might have been shared to the Russians. But I think, and picking up on what Peter said, I think what the Putin regime will do is to point fingers to a foreign hand in this and to blame outsiders for what happened here. But clearly, the U.S. intelligence had reliable intelligence either from human sources or from technical means that gave them the insight in advance for this attack. And it's quite unfortunate and regretful that there wasn't measures taken to prevent this attack from taking place.
Ambassador McFaul, this is the kind of thing that under most circumstances, a functional democracy, right, would obviously, there might be an election called or something else like that. But let's look at, say, the last year, year and a half of Putin's leadership. You have an unpopular war in the Ukraine. You had a literal revolt of one of his most popular generals. You have shootings of important aides of his and sort of gangland 20s style, drive-by shootings, et cetera, and now you have this kind of attack. Even with a sort of sham election just days ago, what is likely happening within the sort of political sphere of Russia right now? Are generals and other leaders beginning to question Putin? Because this is not a resume of a strong leader over the last year. These are actually both internal and external issues that appear to show a man who is losing his grip on his country.
I think that's right. Whether you'll hear that from a Russian government official, I doubt. You most certainly won't see it on Russian state television. What you're going to see instead is a rallying around the flag effect. We need to be tougher. And as Peter was talking about, I suspect, even more crackdown on civil society and various people, even more control. But already there's an undertone going on my social media channels from Russians inside Russia, from outside, saying, if we're so strong, why did this happen? Why are we focusing on, phantom enemies like Nazis in Ukraine or LGBT activists when we have these real threats? And I don't want to overstate it because this is a very strong authoritarian regime inside Russia. But that has already happened in the initial phases suggests that will linger. And that is a problem for Vladimir Putin. It reminds me a little bit of the debate we saw that has been developing inside Israel. Of course, everybody rallied after October 7th against that horrific terrorist attack. But then people began to ask questions. Why did it happen? The big difference, of course, is that Israel is a democracy and open society. Russia is not. But I think that will linger for Putin. This is not a good look for him, especially when he just told everybody that he's this strong leader that everybody allegedly supported in the elections just last week.
Yeah, it seems like his only strength is eliminating his political enemies after the fact. And that's not the sign of a strong leader or a dictator. Ambassador Michael McFaul, Peter Baker, and John Brennan, thank you so much for starting us off on the show today on The Readout. Coming up, Donald Trump has less than 72 hours to pay his $454 million bond in his civil fraud case. More on that next on The Readout.
Today and every day, Planned Parenthood is committed to ensuring that everyone has the information and resources they need to make their own decisions about their bodies, including abortion care. Lawmakers who oppose abortion are attacking Planned Parenthood, which means affordable, high-quality, basic health care for more than 2 million people is at stake. The right to control our bodies and get the health care we need has been stolen from us. And now, politicians in nearly every state have introduced bills that would block people from getting the sexual and reproductive care they need. Planned Parenthood believes everyone deserves health care, It's a human right. That's why they fight every day to push for common sense policies that protect our right to control our own bodies and against policies that interfere with decisions between patients and their doctor. Planned Parenthood needs your support now more than ever. With supporters like you, we can reclaim our rights and protect and expand access to abortion care. Visit PlannedParenthood.org/future. That's PlannedParenthood.org/future.
It's the burning political question on everyone's mind this year. Will Donald Trump face criminal trial before the November election? Well, we could get an answer as early as next week. Monday was supposed to be day one of Trump's New York hush money trial, but it was pushed back to mid-April after prosecutors handed over a last-minute batch of documents. Instead, on Monday, Judge Marchand will hold a hearing to assess that evidence, and he is expected to set a trial date. But even though it may seem like Trump's delay tactics are working, there is one thing that he can't delay anymore, and that is the $454 million he owes New York Attorney General Letitia James. And the clock is ticking, as Trump has less than 72 hours to put up the money. Or the AG can begin seizing his bank accounts or properties in any state, including potentially Trump Tower or Mar-a-Lago. And despite the fact that Trump's lawyers say he's been unable to secure a bond, Trump, in one of his unhinged overnight all-cap social media rants, claimed that, quote, through hard work, talent, and luck, he actually has almost $500 million in cash, which is basically just undercutting his own lawyers' arguments. Joining me now to discuss is Charles Coleman, civil rights attorney, former Brooklyn prosecutor and MSNBC legal analyst, and one of the best dressed people on the air. Great to see you, Charles. And David K. Johnston, founder of DCReport.org and author of The Big Cheat, one of the best experts on Trump ever. David K., I'm going to start with you. This from a legal and a political standpoint, we've all been terrified about the fact that Donald Trump is going to use all the delaying tactics that he can to not have to pay his fines and not be held accountable. But I want you to contextualize this, which you do an excellent job of. Isn't this just exactly how Trump does everything? Hasn't he always had a life of running up bills and fines and then getting out of it? That's what I'm seeing here. Is that what you see?
Oh, for the whole 35 years I've covered Donald, it's been the same story. He's not a wealth builder. He is a money extractor, and it runs through his hands like water. And that's why he's constantly needed for cash. Now, on Monday, it's possible he will pull a financial rabbit out of the hat yet again. We may not know how he got the $500 million. We may not know to whom he is beholden. But don't be surprised if somehow at the last moment he comes up with the money to delay any enforcement action by depositing it with the court.
Charles, I've asked this question, you know, before, and I've asked several different experts. Is there a sort of order or a strategy to what assets Tish James may take from Trump if he's not able to come up with the money? Like I said, I have my dream that Trump Tower will be covered with a giant banner that says Spirit of Halloween. That probably won't happen. They're not going to take the Trump Tower. They're not going to take the letters on day one, right? But what do they go after first? And is there a strategy to that? Or is it just what's the easiest thing to acquire from her office?
Well, I think those two things are one and the same in the sense that you go after what's easiest not only to acquire, but also to liquidate. When you're talking about real property assets, Jason, one of the difficulties that you think about if you are Letitia James in her office is, number one, the notion of valuing those things is very difficult because you have to get them appraised. And then once you get them appraised, you have to go into the long and protracted process of actually liquidating those things. Not to mention that in between that process, you actually have to manage those things. So Mar-a-Lago, for example, is a resort. In the middle of seizing Mar-a-Lago, you would then have to take over and assume responsibility for the management of Mar-a-Lago so that the property value did not go down significantly. That's not the business that Letitia James and the Office of the Attorney General are in the state of New York. So that's not going to be attractive. So all of these things are going to be considerations when you talk about what the value is, but then also what is the ease in which we can turn this property, if you will, or this asset into hard cash, because that's what is king in this situation.
Yeah, the idea that we're basically trying to, you know, that the government office is going to have to try and flip Donald Trump sounds like an HGTV show, but it's actually the tactical legal process we have to go through. Charles, I want to follow up on this because I think this is really interesting. What would be a potential danger? Let's say the New York office did go after Mar-a-Lago. Wouldn't there be a potential risk that the money it takes to manage that asset ends up eating away at the eventual value of selling it? Is that one of the dangers?
That's absolutely the case. I can tell you as a former prosecutor that you do not necessarily want to seize things that are not real property in terms of, you know, cars, boats, homes, or things of that nature. You don't want to seize businesses. You want hard cash or things that you can very easily auction off, liquidate, and get the cash for right away. Something like Mar-a-Lago is a very risky item or property to seize because, again, that value is going to fluctuate in such a way that the Attorney General's office could potentially lose money, or the value that they seize it for may not ultimately be the value that they get once they liquidate it. And then at that point, the judge is going to look at them and say, well, that's your fault, not necessarily the fault of the defendant in this case. And so you have to be very careful with the types of assets that you go after, whether they're real property or otherwise, because you can't control what happens once you take control of them, especially if they're active businesses, the likes of which you're not responsible or accustomed to actually running. So you're not used to that.
David, there is another potential windfall other than, say, Russia and foreign money, which is where Trump seems to usually get his money from. But there is another potential windfall he has. There is the sort of going public of this Truth Social, and Trump could get access to up to $3 billion. But there's a catch to this. What Politico is saying right now is that even though Trump's stake will be tied up for much of the year under a so-called lockup agreement, a normal arrangement for such deals to ensure that insiders don't bail as soon as a company goes public and push down the stock price. Trump could try to obtain a waiver from that rule, but even then, he wouldn't be able to sell more than a small fraction of his stake at any given time, up to 1% of the outstanding shares every quarter. David, again, Trump has made a career of trying to skirt around these kinds of rules. Do you think he's going to just try and cash out a Truth Social and then fight in court to see if he can use all the money now rather than trying to use it later? Because that seems to be the only way, other than going to a foreign government, that he could get the kind of cash he needs.
Well, actually, Wall Street came up with more than 30 years ago other techniques to do this sort of thing. During the dot-com era, we had all these executives who got founders who got $100,000 salaries, but they suddenly owned yachts and airplanes. And, you know, where did they get the money? They didn't sell any stock. What you do is you pledge the stock to one of the investment houses or wealthy people, in Donald's case, perhaps, and they advance you cash against it. Now, of course, the risk they run is that 6 months from now, the stock will be worthless, but they can also do what's called a naked short of that stock, and they have his stock as a short, which would insulate them. I'm reminded here of the line in Trading Places where Eddie Murphy says, "Oh, I get it. You guys are bookies." And Donald can probably find a way to get someone to finance it, but if anybody is financing Donald, if he doesn't have, as this crazy claim today, he's got $500 million, we need to really be worried about who's behind this. And I don't mean the person who wrote the check. I mean, who's behind them, because we've never had a president in hock to other people. Right now, he's in hock to a Swiss insurance company for $83 million. This is a national security nightmare. The framers of our Constitution, who were very careful to protect a president from income by the state governments or foreign interests, never thought about debt.
And certainly not in this particular way. And I love your reference to Trading Places. I have this image of two administrations later, and there's a poor Donald Trump on a park bench, and someone drops him some cash. And he's like, "Mortimer, we're back." Charles, I got to ask you this. One of the concerns also that people have is that if Donald Trump is able to continue to delay, he gets into the White House, and then some sort of magic happens. It seems to me that legally, wouldn't he be required to pay this back even if he ends up being president of the United States? Even if he may have immunity from criminal prosecution, but if you owe money, you still owe money even if you became president, correct?
That is correct, Jason. Under our current system of laws, if you will, there's nothing that would insulate Donald Trump, even if he were the president, from having to satisfy a judgment that existed before he took office. Even if he owed money as the president, that would not be something that he could shield himself of or sort of wave his magic wand as an executive of the United States of America and make it disappear. I think that people need to understand in terms of what he should be worried about, both the E. Jean Carroll judgment, as well as this judgment with respect to Letitia James, are things that he will inevitably have to deal with because he can't do anything about them, even if he's sitting at the Resolute desk at 1600 Pennsylvania. After that, the case in Fulton County has to become the biggest issue that he's dealing with, because even if he replaces the AG, for example, on the federal level with the DOJ, that is a state case and he can't do anything about. So those two things are things he has to be incredibly mindful of.
Charles Coleman and David K. Johnson, thank you so much for joining us tonight on The Readout. Up next, Attorney General Merrick Garland taking his time on legal action against Trump has been a major source of frustration for many, with his January 6th trial now possibly not happening before the election. There's new reporting on what was going on behind the scenes at the DOJ. That's next on The Readout.
From Freakonomics Radio, a new series about a role model we didn't know we needed.
So many crazy things really did happen to him.
The physicist Richard Feynman was one of the most brilliant scientists of his generation, but he was also a troublemaker, an obsessive, and a man who spoke truth to power. Along the way, he created a blueprint for how to lead a life of honest inquiry.
He was a brilliant theoretical physicist, but what really made him stand out was his humanity.
The curious, brilliant, vanishing Mr. Feynman on Freakonomics Radio.
Hey, everyone. It's Ted from Consumer Cellular, the guy in the orange sweater, and this is your wake-up call. If you're paying too much for wireless service, you don't have to keep having that nightmare. Consumer Cellular has the same fast, reliable coverage as the leading carriers for less. And for a limited time, new customers receive their second month free when they sign up and use promo code MONTHFREE by May 31st. So why keep spending more than you have to? Seriously, wake up and call 1-888-FREEDOM or visit ConsumerCellular.com.
Taxes, fees, and other third-party charges will apply. See website for additional details.
That is the number of days left until Election Day. And that's all the time Donald Trump has left to continue to delay his criminal trials before he potentially gets the chance to wipe the slate clean for his alleged transgressions. But should we even be in a position where we are frantically watching the clock, hoping that some accountability will be served to a man who tried to take over the country? Because you have to remember that some of these investigations have been years in the making over at the Department of Justice, and there have been criticisms leveled at Attorney General Merrick Garland for not having moved faster. The New York Times is out today with a new look into Garland's efforts over the past few years and the concerns over his by-the-book caution and wariness to appear partisan. The Times notes, quote, "In trying to avoid even the smallest mistakes, Mr. Garland might have made one big one, not recognizing that he could end up racing the clock. Like much of the political world and official Washington, he and his team did not count on Mr. Trump's political resurrection after January 6th and his fast victory in the 2024 Republican presidential primary, which has complicated the prosecution and given the former president leverage in court." Joining me now to discuss is Jill Winebanks, former assistant Watergate special prosecutor, MSNBC legal analyst, and co-host of the Sisters in Law podcast. Jill, thank you so much for joining us tonight on The Readout. I am who they speak. I am one of the many people who has been complaining for years that Merrick Garland has taken too much time, that it's not just an issue of caution. It almost looks like complicity at this particular point. In your perspective, given your political experience, given your legal experience, is there any justification for why Merrick Garland has worked so slowly in a situation that was so, it is, continues to be so absolutely crucial to the future of this country?
Let me say that I have joined you in being critical of Merrick Garland. My husband is the only one I know who is more critical than I am. But you do have to be careful when you're dealing with a unique circumstance, a first-time prosecution of a former president. You want to make it exactly as good as it could possibly be. You want to cover every possible error that could come up and make sure you have evidence beyond a reasonable doubt. You don't want to aim for the king and lose. On the other hand, the length of time that this has taken is unconscionable. And I hate to cite a trite phrase that justice delayed is justice denied. And if as the article suggests, Merrick Garland didn't foresee the delays that Trump would bring to this case, I find that hard to believe because those were very predictable. His past history of cases would show you that delay, diversion, distraction, those are his best legal defenses. And so it was predictable and it should have been happening. Now, he did, within 6 days of January 6th, appoint an inspector general to look at how the Justice Department had handled this. And there was plenty to look at there, as we all know. So he wasn't doing nothing. And in a way, although I was very unmoved by the New York Times reporting, because it does show that he was taking action. He wasn't sitting around doing nothing. So it didn't move the needle in terms of persuading unpersuaded people that he wasn't doing nothing. And it didn't meet the goal, which I think was Merrick Garland trying to show that he really has been a good attorney general and that he should serve a second term. That's what I think the goal was. I don't think it got anywhere near achieving that goal.
I want to read some of this headline here. Inside Garland's effort to prosecute Trump, prosecutors in the FBI spent months sticking to their traditional playbook. They started with smaller players and worked upward despite the transparent, well-documented steps taken by Mr. Trump himself in public and behind the scenes to retain power after voters rejected his bid for another term. Look, Jill, I say this all the time. If you want to get Tony, fine. You flip Michael, right? If you want to flip a corner boy in order to get Omar or Stringer Bell, okay, fine. But that doesn't make any sense in a coup. It's almost as if no one in the Department of Justice understood any semblance of history. The vast majority of people who attacked us on January 6th, they had no direct connection to Trump. There's no one they can actually flip on. So can you explain perhaps why Merrick Garland, anybody in his office, thought that going after a political coup, a violent political coup, that you could use the same strategy as you would going after a drug dealer or a mobster?
I think the headline and your statement captures exactly what the worst mistake was. And that was, in many cases, you do try to flip the underlings to talk about the higher-ups, but not in a case like this where you saw it happen live. You didn't need to spend all the resources Department of Justice spent immediately on getting the rioters. Yes, they deserve to be prosecuted, and they should be. But if you have limited resources, then you should have started at the hotel war room, at all the people who were there. You should have started with, how did they not know about Cassidy Hutchinson? During Watergate, going back that far, secretaries were some of the best witnesses because people don't pay attention to what they're saying in front of them, and right, they hear and they know. And so why weren't they looking at the aides to all these top people? That would have been a better place to start, was starting maybe not with the chief of staff to the president, but the chief of staff to the chief of staff would have been a good place. And look what we got from her. So I think there were definite mistakes made. There's no way that in a case like this, anybody except maybe the leaders of the Proud Boys who might have had a connection, there was some reason to look at those, right, who were being charged with seditious conspiracy, because they did seem to, if not directly to the president, and there's some evidence that there were calls to the White House, certainly to, right, the war room, at the hotel, they had connections. And so that would have been the lowest I would have gone. And I would have diverted, right, all the resources to looking at Donald Trump and his top aides.
Yeah, it seemed like a waste of resources to be running after a bunch of Twitter terrorists who came to D.C. for the weekend, as opposed to the people who are actually planning everything. Jill Weinbanks, thank you so much for joining us tonight on The Readout. Very much appreciate your insight.
Thank you, Jason.
Coming up, if the Republican Party wasn't already divided enough, MAGA is gonna MAGA, with Marjorie Taylor Greene filing a motion to fire the speaker. That's what's up next on The Readout with Jason Johnson. Earlier today, we got yet another reminder what an absolute joke the modern-day Republican organization has truly become. The day started with Georgia Congresswoman Marjorie Taylor Greene, Trump's dutiful bulldog in the House, filing a motion to vacate against Speaker Mike Johnson. Haven't we been here before? She's put him on notice that she wants him out of there. The motion came just minutes before about half of her Republican colleagues approved a $1.2 trillion spending package, tossing the government shutdown hot potato over to the Senate. Greene accused Speaker Johnson of abandoning Republicans because he didn't agree to shut down the government over spending.
This is a betrayal of the American people. This is a betrayal of Republican voters. I filed the motion to vacate today, but it's more of a warning and a pink slip.
Is this the fight you want to have in an election year?
Absolutely. It's the fight I want to have in an election year.
You know, people are getting sick and tired of being sick and tired, even within the Republican Party. Republican Congressman Mike Gallagher of Wisconsin announced today that he was resigning next month after previously announcing that he was retiring at the end of his term. He's joining Colorado Tea Party Congressman Ken Buck, who also chose early retirement, effective today. He told reporters that retirement was more appealing than the MAGA Republican dysfunction. The MAGA House majority will be down to one single seat. Joining me now to discuss is Dr. Christina Greer, political scientist and host of the Blackest Questions podcast, and Fernand Armandi, Democratic pollster and MSNBC political analyst. Dr. Greer, Fernand, great to have you all tonight. I will begin with you, Professor. So in my experience, if you have a lot of people of one party choosing to retire rather than run again, that tends to be a sign that they feel like they're not going to keep their jobs this fall, or that they're not going to be in a position of power after the next election. Is that what we see happening here with these Republicans, or are they just saying, I just don't want to work there anymore, even if Trump became president?
I think it could be both and, Jason. But here's the thing. Oftentimes, it's the institution like, say, the RNC that would help them get reelected, that would give them the tools they need. And so many Republicans just recognize that their party is in such disarray. They can see that it's slowly but surely fully becoming the financial party of Donald Trump. And they're choosing to just pack up their marbles and go home and not even give their constituents the decency for staying throughout their term. There are also a growing segment of Republicans who recognize they can cash out now and actually make a lot more money outside of Congress by either lobbying when the time comes or serving as consultants. And so the work of going to D.C., which is a very dysfunctional place with so many factions within the Republican Party, just makes it such that they don't feel like doing it anymore. And it was never, for many of them, about serving the people of their district and serving the people of America.
Fernand, we're going to move from the organization of dysfunction, because they're no longer a party, they're just a dime store front for the MAGA terrorist movement, to an actual governing party, which is the Democrats. We have to take a look here. The Biden administration, a new announcement, they're about to forgive $5.8 billion in student debt for nearly 78,000 borrowers. And that's not all. If you look at this in context, Biden has forgiven $143.6 billion in loans, which has helped 3.96 million Americans. Fernand, why is this not the topic of news and tweets and conversations every day from every Democrat? That's 4 million people. That's probably going to be the margin for the next presidential election. Shouldn't we be talking more, and shouldn't the Biden administration be talking more about all the great things they're actually doing for people, because the other side can't seem to get themselves together?
Jason, as always, you ask the right questions. But here, I think we have to go to the sage of American politics in the 21st century for the answer to your question. Donald Trump, he was right all along. Remember when he said, you're going to get sick and tired of all the winning. We're going to do so much winning and get so much done that you're going to be bored and tired by all the winning and getting everything done. except he was talking about Joe Biden and his administration, because you can add this accomplishment to the list of yet another in what already is the most historic presidency of the last 60 years and actually getting things done for the American people on all sectors, climate change, the economy, healthcare policy, here in the case for relieving this student debt for millions of Americans. So it just builds and adds to the case that the Biden campaign is making now and will continue to make. And if they make the election about that and about what this dysfunction on the other side represents if they regain power, I think they're going to win comfortably. And I think what Marjorie Taylor Greene did earlier today is just another nail in that coffin. What's happening right now, Jason, as we speak, there's panic in the Republican Party, because I think the feeling is after this 2-week recess, which starts tonight, right, there's a possibility we could come back with Speaker Hakeem Jeffries if they get a couple of Republican members to flip or exit the Congress given this dysfunction.
Dr. Greer, I want to talk a little bit about dysfunction sort of in our public discourse as well. So there's been a big split within the MAGA political journalism ecosphere. We have Candace Owens, who is now leaving the Daily Wire. She's going to move on her own. I don't usually concern myself with the rantings and ravings of someone who says homophobic, misogynistic, anti-Semitic things. But I do think there is an issue going on when it comes to the number of people who are platforming her. We've seen in the weeks prior to this break, Candace Owens showing up with Joe Budden on his podcast, Candace Owens showing up with Charlamagne the God, oftentimes being given free rein to spout disinformation and nonsense with people who seem incapable or disinterested in holding her accountable. Dr. Greer, what is our solution to this? Because if we're going to have people with connections to the audience spending more time with disinformation and racist nonsense than they are talking about student loans, we're not going to have enough of an informed public to be prepared to vote this fall.
Right. You know, I talked to our friend and colleague, Sosa Osa, who is doing really interesting work about misinformation and disinformation in this election cycle. And what she rightly points out in Onyx Strategies is that the paywalls for real information continue to increase. So more and more people are getting their information from free sources where misinformation and disinformation are running rampant. We have celebrities who are given platforms, not just on major networks, but they have radio stations and podcasts, which for many people are free. And so they invite people on with zero interest in pushing back on outlandish theories, or, you know, really problematic and, dare I say, dangerous propositions for voters writ large. And so it is incumbent upon the Biden administration and their surrogates to essentially do what Donald Trump does, which is just repeat the same thing over and over again. The difference is the Biden administration can actually repeat the truth over and over again and make it a reality. But we've seen Republicans just, if they say it long enough, it becomes part of our discourse. And so we have to combat that by making sure that the surrogates, I mean, the fact that student loan forgiveness wasn't mentioned in the first 5 minutes, 10 minutes, or even 15 minutes of the State of the Union says a lot. We need to make sure people actually are armed with not just correct information, but ways to spot disinformation. You know, if it sounds a little too good to be true, ask yourself, when someone starts using absolutes as though Kamala Harris has done nothing, what does that actually mean? And ask yourself, what did Mike Pence do? So all of a sudden, we have a litmus test for vice presidents that we've never had before, right? And so I think we need to be cautious as to why so many people without credibility are being platformed across so many different media outlets and media franchises in different ways.
For now, I got to ask you this very quickly. There was a story that came out this week talking about the fact that, you know, 30 pollsters have all said that if the election happened tomorrow, that Joe Biden would get elected. Obviously, the election is not happening tomorrow. Again, I always say this and I always like going to you about this. Really quickly, talk people off the ledge and remind them that any poll that's coming out right now has little or no bearing on what's going to happen in the next 7 months.
I mean, take it from this pollster, you know, the polls don't matter a hill of beans today. When they start to really get matter, Jason, is when we get closer to voting late September, certainly early October, when there's going to be a lot of ballots out. But I think the polling today does show that it is getting tighter. But Biden has moved ahead for the first time in a while. So he's inching past now where Trump was before.
Right. Dr. Christina Greer and Fernand Armandi, thank you so much for joining us tonight on the readout. We'll be right back. And that's tonight's readout. Joy returns on Monday. And speaking of Joy, be sure to catch the latest episode of my podcast, A Word with Jason Johnson. Joy is my guest to talk about her amazing best-selling book, Medgar and Merle, and the love story that awakened America.
Do you find yourself searching for true crime podcasts that are different from what you're always recommended? Do you want to make a real difference in the cases that you're following? Well, you're a crime junkie. And I'm Ashley Flowers, the creator and host of the number one true crime podcast, Crime Junkie. There are hundreds of episodes already available, and each Monday we dive into the details of cases spanning from some of the most infamous to those that you have never heard covered before. Listen to Crime Junkie podcast now, wherever you're listening.